Adamski, Flying Saucers Farewell. Here is audio extract. Foreword. The purpose of this book is to share with my many friends throughout the world knowledge gained through personal experiences during the years since Inside the Spaceships was published in 1955. I wish to express deep appreciation to my devoted colleagues and friends, from this world and other planets, who have assisted me in preparing the material contained herein. George Adamski. Introduction. For 13 years I have pursued the elusive flying saucers, investigating every available fact in an attempt to solve the many questions created by their presence. Now many of the riddles have been solved on the basis of scientific proof, and I am firmly convinced that men from other planets have arrived on Earth. In this conviction I am not alone. Many scientists and government officials now admit their belief that people from other planets in our solar system have come to Earth, and that flying saucers are spacecraft of extraterrestrial origin. In 1957 I first met George Adamski, space lecturer philosopher who, with the British writer Desmond Leslie, co-authored Flying Saucers Have Landed, one of the most informative documents to be published on spacecraft and their origin. Adamski's startling account of his meeting with a man from Venus met with tremendous response from readers throughout the world. Since my first meeting with George Adamski, we have worked together on an extensive study of what some officials prefer to call unidentified flying objects. My interest in UFOs actually began many years ago in Boise, Idaho, where I lived at the time of Kenneth Arnold's first report in 1947. In those days I worked as a radio repairman for an auto-electric shop and had serviced the radios in Arnold's private plane and automobile. Arnold visited the shop shortly after the Mount Rainier incident, when he sighted a formation of UFOs, and I was very impressed with his story. I knew Arnold to be a sober individual and had no reason to doubt his experience. I maintained this interest for several years afterward. In the summer of 1951, I moved to Seattle, Washington, where I read occasional UFO reports in the newspapers, most of them tongue-in-cheek accounts which hinted that hallucinations, or perhaps crackpots, might be behind die flying saucer stories. Then I bought a pocketbook entitled Flying Saucers Are Real, by Donald D. Kehoe. This book convinced me that saucers were indeed real and were of interplanetary origin. I began to purchase every UFO book I could get my hands on, as fast as it was released to the public. All contact claims I dismissed as pure fantasy, written by willful hoaxers or by sincere though deluded people. One morning I read an advertisement in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer requesting that persons interested in UFOs contact Robert J. Gribble of the Civilian Flying Saucer Intelligence. This group later changed its name to Aerial Phenomena Research Group. I contacted Gribble and joined his organization. A few months later, Gribble invited me to become an associate director in the group and to participate more actively in its UFO research program. This I did and got in on the ground floor, so to speak, of what I consider to be the best and the most scientific investigation agency in the UFO field. Each month clippings would pour in from every major newspaper in the world. Gribble maintained large maps pinpointing all the major sightings and landings in the world. Separate maps were used for other incidents connected with the UFOs. In July of 1957 I moved to Southern California. At this time a new opportunity presented itself. I was very close to the majority of the so-called contactees. Some months previously I had come to the realization that contacts of some kind must have been made. If the situation were reversed and our ships were flying around another planet for several years, they would certainly in that length of time try to land and contact some of the natives. If we landed and accidentally ran across an inhabitant, no matter what his station in life might be, we would certainly attempt some sort of communication. The space people would be no different from us in that respect. As a result of all this, I decided I'd better pull my head out of the sand and investigate the contactee claimants. I drove hundreds of miles on weekends and visited many people. All of them were fine, friendly persons, but I was very disappointed. Not one had proof of any kind. Many were establishing cults, with one in California even incorporating as a religion. None of these people were genuine. Some freely stated their experiences were not physical, but occurred as psychic or astral contacts. Several claimed contact via Ouija boards, automatic handwriting, trances, or equally ridiculous methods. None of them seemed to realize these incidents were products of their own wishful thinking and they meant absolutely nothing to anyone but themselves. At this point I was so disgusted with the whole flying saucer business I didn't even bother to visit George Adamski. I assumed he was just like the rest. A few months later my family and I traveled to Mount Palomar to see the 200-inch Hale telescope. After an enjoyable day on top, we were returning down the mountain when I noticed Adamski's name on a mailbox. I decided to stop, as I was preparing a series of lectures on flying saucers and I didn't want to talk against someone I had never met. I was determined to expose the whole contactee setup as a hoax. Imagine my surprise when I met a man who appeared to be as distinguished as a college professor and who talked of scientific things as an expert, who claimed his contacts were real and physical and further stated the contacts were in no way connected with so-called mystic phenomena, psychism or spiritualism. Adamski produced clear photographs and affidavits from many witnesses who were present when the photos were taken and the contact established. No one else had ever done this. At last I was getting somewhere, proceeding on a sane, logical course. In Adamski's 16mm color motion picture, the large metallic dome of a spacecraft was clearly visible. Expert photographers had examined his pictures and stated they couldn't even be faked with expensive motion picture studio equipment. Orthographic projections comparing Adamski's films with pictures taken overseas proved that models were not used. Each fact served to cinch the authenticity a little tighter. I became intrigued enough to revisit Adamski, and on a few occasions I met scientists and military technicians who had come for information to be used in their research laboratories. These men took Adamski at face value and I began to gain increased respect for him. I compiled all the information I received about Adamski and of the material he furnished to the research laboratories. Later I read newspaper accounts of how the re-entry heating problem of our missiles had been solved. The method was the same as outlined by Adamski several months previously. I read letters from scientists thanking Adamski for his information and stating the methods he outlined had worked. When the now notorious Strafe letter arrived from the U.S. State Department, I participated in the two-month investigation that followed. Much of the information that arrived concerning the Strafe letter has never been made public, and so I leave it to Adamski to release or hold as he sees fit. The facts boiled down to one thing, though. The Strafe letter was never disproved. The same cover-up was attempted with the letter as with the UFO itself. Before long I was actively working with Adamski in his effort to tell the American public what it should know, as the Strafe letter had asked. During the latter part of 1958, I traveled with Adamski on a 4,000-mile lecture tour reaching as far north as Bellingham, Washington. During the intermission of our lecture in Everett, Washington, a public information officer from Payne Air Force Base came up to us and complimented Adamski on his scientific, down-to-earth and physical approach to the subject. He stated that when the psychics were kicked out of the UFO situation, the Air Force would be able to release its information. He said the mystics had so confused the issue with their false claims of contact that the general public looked with ridicule at the whole matter and refused to accept any of it. After all, what normal, intelligent person would be seen at a seance attended by persons who claimed they left their bodies behind at night and flew off into the wild blue yonder to ride in a spaceship? The average person would never accept a fantastic claim that astral entities and spirits were flying around in invisible ships, materializing and dematerializing at will. Notice how, overnight, the mediums abandoned their Indian guides and substituted spacemen. As a result of my investigation, I wholeheartedly back George Adamski and the other legitimate, though mostly unknown, contactees. So far, Adamski is the only well-known contactee claimant in the United States who has proven legitimate. His photos are the only publicly known pictures to be listed as authentic by the intelligence agencies of many world governments. In the files of certain governments, his name heads the list of authentic contactees. His photos are used universally to illustrate the true appearance of a flying saucer. At one time he was asked to undergo a government security check and lecture at military installations around the world. This he refused to do, since such an arrangement would have bound him to secrecy, closing his information to the public. During Adamski's world tour in 1959, certain heads of governments informed him they were also contactees. It is evident the space visitors have not confined their visits to the United States. In regard to knowledge about the space people and their reasons for coming, the United States falls sadly behind the majority of other nations. Perhaps Americans will soon realize that a vast new horizon has opened before us, a limitless destiny which only the open, alert mind will inherit. Now, let us hear of that destiny from George Adamski, who, I sincerely believe, was one of the first Americans to meet the people from other planets. C.A. Honey. Anaheim, California. July, 1960. Book I. 1. Why They Came. It was in October, 1946, that the USA shot its first radar beam to the moon. This was for experimental purposes. The center of the moon was the target, since our scientists thought they had accurate calculations of the distances between our planet and her satellite. The intent was to learn the time required for a radar signal to travel such a distance through outer space and return. At that time, considerable publicity was given to the feat and its achievement. But, so far as the public has been informed, the matter was dropped there. Yet, in reality, that event was only the beginning of our rapid progress spaceward. According to the space people with whom I have had the pleasure of discussing the subject, the radar signal sent out at that time hit the edge of the moon and ricocheted into space, alerting watchers at their instruments on Mars and Venus. Its strangeness was mistakenly interpreted to be a signal of distress. Immediately they answered with their own signals. When no replies were received, their ships were dispatched to investigate. Naturally, these went to the section of our planet whence the signals had originated. This explains why, in the beginning, more spacecraft were observed over the USA than other parts of the world. And, as it will be when our spaceships reach other planets, some of their craft landed here and there as they found it safe or necessary. Because they were unfamiliar with our terrain and atmosphere, we had been experimenting with atomic bombs and, not long before, had exploded some to end the war, thereby setting up an unnatural condition, or the strength of our planet's magnetic fields. There were more crashes than we realize. Frank Scully reported some of these in 1950 in his book Behind the Flying Saucers. One, if a person happened to be in the vicinity of a landed craft, the crewman inevitably endeavored to meet and talk with him. When successful, they always explained why they had been attracted to Earth in increased numbers. One, Henry Holt and Company, New York. Our space travelers will do the same, I am sure. It is only natural. It was this information that enabled me to tell whether a claimed contactee was telling the truth, or indulging in wishful thinking. Because one having an actual experience of this kind would mention this part of the conversation during his relating of his meeting with people from a spaceship. I have never divulged this fact previously because it would have served as a basis upon which imposters could work. Now, however, I have been given a means of identification, and Dye Brothers have suggested that this information be made public at this time in order to answer many questions heretofore unanswered. In 1946, shortly after the echo of our signal had returned to Earth from the Moon, our scientists began picking up strange code signals which they were unable to understand. Time calculations indicated that these signals were coming from our neighboring planets, in spite of accepted scientific theories that for many reasons human life was impossible there. Other signals seemed to be coming from open space, an unexplainable and unbelievable state of affairs, unless one took space vehicles into consideration. Not only did these signals continue for several months, they are still being received. Our scientists have worked diligently in an effort to decode them. At first, without success. Their accomplishments through the years have naturally been kept secret from the general public. Nonetheless, today in America we have Project OSMA at the Green Bank Radio Observatory in West Virginia, England has her gigantic Jodrell Bank Radio Telescope, Australia has her Mills Cross, along with other radio telescopes, and is now in the process of building a 210-foot circular radio telescope scheduled to be completed in April 1961. This will be the largest in the Southern Hemisphere, but hell, I'm sure there are many others throughout the world, all delicately tuned and receiving signals from space which the scientists are endeavoring to decipher. Our Bible contains several hundred reports of space visitations, all of which have been misinterpreted and misunderstood until recent years, due to the many translations as well as personal interpretations and teachings of biblical records. Today many researchers are conceding that the history of our Earth and its inhabitants was old when our Bible history began. It was prior to that time that interplanetary communication was normal between our planet and her neighbors. Most of our early records have been lost, and our education since has not admitted the possibility of anything of this kind. Yet, regardless of our understanding or lack of it, spacecraft have moved through our atmosphere now and then through the centuries. Many sightings of these craft have been recorded during the centuries, both by scientists and by the man on the street. But because even yet we have not entirely outgrown our fears of the unknown, and certain witchcraft ideas, reports of these sightings have, for the most part, remained in closed files, forgotten because of fear of ridicule and persecution of those having such experiences. Desmond Leslie of London, England, spent years and endless effort in compiling many of these records. The results of his efforts were published in 1953 in Flying Saucers Have Landed Too, in which my report of having met a man from Venus was also included. Two British Book Center, Limited, New York. Visits from spacecraft to our Earth during the past several centuries might be compared to ocean liner visits to some far out of the way island, which is visited perhaps once or twice a year to leave supplies and pick up merchandise of the natives. Occasionally some of their people would wish to remain on Earth to become better acquainted with our people and their ways. A certain percentage of these have liked it here and have remained. Others have returned home after certain lengths of time. In this way the people of our neighboring planets have been able to keep in touch with some conditions on Earth. This practice continues today, with many governments having records of identification for these interplanetary visitors. In 1946, when our signal was first picked up and their ships were alerted with instructions to investigate, an increase in numbers of spacecraft moving through Earth's atmosphere took place. For the following 12 years this increase was continued, with sightings reported over every nation in the world. Official documentary records can be found in the files of practically every nation, as the elusive objects have been picked up on radar screens in the USA, England, Russia, Brazil, New Zealand, Australia, and many others, often over their capital cities as well as above their research laboratories, their testing grounds, moving with and around their missiles as if studying them closely, and at times moving in close proximity to airplanes and ships. Many books have been written which include sightings in large numbers, or singly by individuals alone, or at times in the sight of hundreds of witnesses, as in 1954 in Bilbao, Spain, when a formation of flying saucers flew slowly and at quite low altitude above the multitude so that they could be seen easily without binoculars. In this incident, according to a newspaper report, a portion of the citizens knelt. Rome, too, has had her visits from formations of spacecraft moving overhead, watched by people in the streets. At the time, these were mistakenly taken for Russian squadrons on reconnaissance flights, but there were those who knew better, and later these events were publicized for what they actually were. In Mexico in 1952, in the dark of night, a passenger train was escorted by a flying saucer for more than an hour. Sometimes this craft moved above the train, or it would move ahead and wait for long moments. The glow from this aerial ship was so bright that the passengers were able to see one another, or to read as if in full daylight. Testimony of this event was taken from all the passengers, the crew members, and some technicians who were traveling on the train. These were documented and notarized, and I have been told that these records are in the hands of competent Mexican authorities. Several years ago during Exercise Ardent in England, Dire radar station picked up images of 10 ships that flew from England to Holland above the British Air Forces. Their speed was estimated to be above 30,000 kilometers per hour, according to the report. They suddenly disappeared from the radar screen. From Australia, during the latter part of 1959 and the first half of 1960, detailed published reports were shared with the world about Father Gill, a priest who, with a number of his parishioners and a fellow clergyman, watched a large spacecraft hover not too far above them in their little town in New Guinea, while repairs were being made on the craft. This lasted for a considerable time, and was repeated a few days later. Father Gill traveled through Australia, giving public lectures on the event. He also talked over radio and TV in order to reach as many people as possible with the story of his experiences. During the summer of 1959, an air show was being held in Canada. Thousands of people attended. During the height of the show, a large Russian jet came in, and behind it, but staying a short distance above as the jet landed, was an immense spaceship. According to reports brought to me by several who were there and saw it, portholes along the sides of the gigantic cigar-shaped ship were open and people looked at the multitudes on die ground, as they in turn observed those in the ship. Those in the ship were described to me as men, women, and children, judged from their appearances, differing in color as Earth's people. Changes were made in the faces at the portholes as those having a look moved away to give room to others. Some of the children looked so small it was thought they had to be lifted up to see out, the same as we do with our children. Naturally, I asked my informants, who had driven hundreds of miles to tell me of their experiences, why someone had not taken pictures of both the Russian jet and the spacecraft as they flew in and came to a standstill. The spacecraft remained hovering for several minutes before turning its nose upward and disappearing from sight at a fantastic speed, according to the report. The reply was that, of course, hundreds of people present with cameras had taken pictures, but after the spaceship had moved away, the Canadian military had moved in and confiscated the film in every camera. I was told later that the report of this event went over the press wires at night time, but with instructions to kill it and not let it be published. Through the years, Brazil has had her share of sightings and personal contacts with space visitors. Some of these have been publicized in Brazilian papers, but few have been able to get beyond. Now, I am told, Brazil is making an effort to get other nations to acknowledge the reality of our space visitors, open their secret files on the subject to the people of the world, and make an attempt to be more friendly with these space neighbors in order to learn more from them that the entire world might benefit from their knowledge and their presence. It is a well-known fact that although, for reasons best known to themselves, government officials throughout the world have persistently refused to admit the reality of spacecraft moving through our atmosphere, they do admit the presence of unidentified flying objects. From time to time they endeavor to excuse or explain these things as nothing, due to their own inability to locate the craft upon investigation, perhaps several hours, days or weeks later. But obviously this is merely to pacify the general public, who would be much happier with the truth contained in government files. This consists of authenticated records and photographs, many of which were taken by their own personnel and aircraft. Through the centuries, crewmen of spaceships have taken samples of our Earth, plants, water, etc. for analysis. In this way they have been able to keep informed of changes taking place on the surface of our planet, and in its minerals. And as I told in my book Inside the Spaceships 3, they have taken frequent samples of our atmosphere, especially since our scientists have been experimenting with atomic explosions. Now their researches are becoming more detailed than they have been for thousands of years, because they have become actively interested in us and our planet, and more of their ships have come our way. They know that our planet is undergoing a natural, periodic change which will have its effect upon outer space, and in turn upon their planets in varying degrees. 3AB Large Schumann, Incorporated, New York. When our ships reach the Moon and our neighboring planets, the crewmen will likewise bring back samples of their Earth, plants, water, etc., for scientific analysis and comparison with ours, I'm sure. If it were not for these spaceships moving through our atmosphere in such numbers that they could no longer be denied and discredited by our researchers, and if it were not for the help given Earth's scientists of all nations, both personally and by mental impressions when a researcher's mind was open for inspiration, our space program would not have progressed as it has. Although they have not been able to give us their full knowledge, our friends from space have shared with us as much as we were able to accept. As with all nature, growth and progress is slow, so we must grow in respect and understanding of the powers with which we are working before we can successfully harness and use them beneficially. Our scientists are doing just this, and within a matter of a few years, we will be joining our neighbors in interplanetary flight in our own Earth-made ships, if we are wise and forego further destructive wars that may well annihilate mankind from the face of this Earth. Our neighbors on other planets had to go through the growing stage, just as our scientists have, except they have not had the setbacks we have experienced through a history of wars and destruction. They too were helped by those who had learned the answers to space travel. On Venus, Mars, and some of the other planets in our system, scientists studied deeply the secrets of nature, her actions and reactions, with satisfactory results. Thus, with the help of other space travelers and inspiration from nature, they succeeded centuries ago in accomplishing that which today we are endeavoring to do. Strange as it may seem to us who have been taught our present system of mathematics, nature works on the principle of one and one adding up to three. The positive and negative, brought together in relationship, result in an effect. The third part of the equation, the offspring, in which a certain percentage of the original two primal forces has been maintained. In other words, the offspring has the benefits of its parents within itself. Were it not for the operation of this law, there would be no food to eat, nor continuance of life of any kind. The law too was known and used on Earth centuries ago, but somewhere the zero was injected into our mathematics. Nowhere in nature can inactivity or a state of nothingness exist, as represented by the zero. Thus there is no 10, 20, etc. in natural law. The cosmic principle of mathematics takes us from 1 to 9, but does not go into numbers, plus nothing. Instead, it progresses from 9, to 9 plus 1, which might be expressed as 9.1. Upon reaching 9 plus 9, 9.9, the count proceeds to a multiple factor of 9, 18. From there it progresses to 18.1, and so on until 18.9 again becomes a multiple of 9, making 27. And so on without end. Because of our introduction of zero, or nothing, into our mathematical systems, it may take many years before we learn to think in cosmic mathematical terms. In Behind the Flying Saucers 4, Frank Scully mentioned that in the first crashed spacecraft examined by our scientists some 12 to 15 years ago, all measurements were found to be divisible by 9. Thus he gave the first clue to cosmic mathematics used in construction of the spacecraft. For Henry Holt & Co., New York, although one of the first books written on this subject of spacecraft, and bitterly denied by the opposition who feared the acceptance of such facts even in those days, this book stands as one that has never been disproved. Of the hundreds of books written regarding space visitors and their ships, this remains one of the comparatively few authentic treatments of the subject. Built in compliance with cosmic principle, these ships operate on cosmic forces. We have much yet to learn about these forces, but our scientists are researching constantly in an effort to gain this understanding. Study of the atom is their first effort. They have learned much, both of its dangers and the potential for constructive uses of the atom. Atomic blasts such as we have developed are destructive in a terrible way. Why, when the atom is considered to be the building block of all forms? In nature atoms blend with others for which they have an affinity and harmony results. But in our scientific efforts we have divided natural atomic combinations and have forced together elements that have no affinity for one another. Negatives or positives, deny their natural opposites, exert all their power to part company and seek those opposites